Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18+ in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.
E-Pokes! Hello and welcome back to Epochs. After the long series about Henry V, I thought it'd be time for something completely different. I'll just do a one-off bit of a palate cleanser this time. So I thought I wanted to talk a little bit about something I'd meant to talk about for a while, but hadn't really found the exact opportunity during the train of Epochs episodes. Talk about a bit of modern war, talk about air power specifically, and with what's gone on recently, you may be watching this months or years from now, but in recent times, in the summer of 2025, there was a big amount of bombings on Iran, or Iran and Israel bombing each other and the Americans getting involved. And it's just something I've wanted to talk about for a while, the history of air power. I've sort of touched on it once or twice here or there. I did an interview with Tim Davis, the ex-RAF fast jet pilot, but that was talking more about the aeroplanes. Where I want to talk a bit about the politics, even the morality of air power. And I think one of the first things to say is how relatively new the whole thing is, right? Men have been fighting wars on the ground, land armies, for thousands of years, and even naval warfare for thousands of years. But we've only been taken to the skies in powered flight since 1903, right? And it's only really since World War One that any large amount of air combat has ever taken place. So it's a 20th century thing. So it was all quite new. And I want to talk about really how we got to where we are today, where you've got something like the B-2 bomber, the B-2 stealth bomber, dropping giant munitions, 30,000-pound specialised munitions. How did we end up there? Well, the idea, the very concept that Israel and Iran might just launch rockets more or less indiscriminately, certainly on the Iranian part, more or less indiscriminately on cities full of civilians. So yeah, I want to talk all about that. One of the first things I'd like to talk about to sort of frame the whole thing is something to do, because we are talking about death and destruction and misery and mutilations and maimings, very often of completely innocent people, women and children and animals and everything. So something I wanted to talk about was the so-called trolley problem, or the trolley dilemma. That is a sort of a thought experiment where if you imagine a trolley or a train on railroad tracks, and there's five people tied to the railroad tracks, and the train cannot be stopped. But you're standing there with a lever in your hand and you can divert the train at the last minute to miss the five people. But it'll be diverted onto another bit of track where there's one person also tied down. You know, do you do it? Do you pull the lever? You know, one person will still have to die, but you'll save five. I mean, the obvious answer is yes, of course you do. It's no question. But, you know, what if, though, that one person is your son or daughter or your mother or father? And you have to watch them get squashed and cut to pieces. And the other five people you don't know. And you never see them get killed anyway. What then? Would you still do it then? And if you say no, let the five people die. Well, what if it was 10 people? What if it was 20? What if it was 200? How many before you say, okay, no, I'll kill someone I love to save those people? What if it was 20,000? What if it was 20 million? You know, so that's a sort of a thought experiment. But that sort of thing does and has absolutely come into play. So the question, another way of putting it is, when does a murder or an atrocity, many, many murders, or a war crime, when does a war crime become justified to prevent an even worse war crime? And this isn't just purely hypothetical. This is what has played out many, many times, and I'm sure it will do in the future again. Do you order the incineration of 80,000 civilians in a single flash in order to save millions of your soldiers. Again, it's easy to sit there in your armchair and just say yes to that. But then what if it's not so cut and dry? What if it's, we'll kill hundreds of thousands of people and maybe it saves millions of people? Or we'll kill hundreds of thousands of people and maybe it saves about the same number. What then? Or if the numbers are less, we'll kill tens or hundreds of thousands of people to save just a few thousand or a few hundred people on our side, trading the lives of enemy civilians for your soldiers. You know, it's a difficult dilemma, one that certainly many leaders and military planners have had to face. And as I say, probably will do again, almost certainly will do again. The podcaster Dan Carlin once put it, imagine it's 1939, just before World War II starts, and there's one nuke in the world and it belongs to Britain and you're the leader of Britain. There's one nuke in the world and you can nuke Berlin on day one of World War II and it wipes out Berlin, kills everyone in Berlin, but stops World War II, or at least in Europe, where, you know, many, many, many more people than would have been killed in that nuclear blast would die. But they haven't yet. Would you do it? Not just the morality or ethical question. Would you have the guts, the balls to pull the trigger on that thing, so to speak? You know, there's many such thought experiments. So to talk about the history of it, going back to the very beginning, I'd like to go back to sort of the 18th century and balloons, men first leaving the surface of the earth in balloons. I mean, now it seems to us, doesn't it, completely obvious that whoever controls the skies, whoever's got air dominance, has not only got a massive advantage over any opponent in war, but it's sort of over already. That's sort of the whole ball game. If you control the skies and your enemy can't stop you, then it will probably just be a matter of time. That seems sort of completely obvious to us now, but it wasn't obvious straight away. I mean, I even saw Pete Hegseth say peace through strength. I saw him say it a couple of times. Now, that's a blast from the past. A blast, a pun unintended. They used to say that a lot during the Cold War, that we'll keep the peace by being extremely strong. Not just the Americans, all sorts of people have said that, or variants on it have been said for much longer than before the Cold War. But to hear that trotted out, I haven't heard that in quite a while, peace through strength, is that, you know, we'll bomb you flat to keep the peace. Yeah, it was quite remarkable when I heard Hegseth say that. When we look at various things that have happened during the 20th century, probably obviously there's the atomic bombing of Japan, but then the massive bombings in North Korea or Vietnam, the fire bombings of Germany and Japan during World War II. You know, how did we get there? Because when air power first started, nearly all the great powers in the world were aghast to think that something like that might lay in the future and that they wouldn't do it, even before World War II, even between World War I and World War II. Lots of countries, even the United States, said that they absolutely didn't want to kill loads of civilians unnecessarily. But, you know, that's what ended up happening. So how did we get there? Well, let's go back to the very beginning of it. It was the French that first built, in the very late 18th century, first built effectively a hot air balloon and were able to leave the earth. And some people, far-seeing people, saw immediately that something like this, or a future version of this invention, this discovery, could be used for war. Benjamin Franklin, very, very clever man, a genius, really, a polymath. He saw right away that, well, you could maybe drop grenades or bombs from this thing, fly over your enemy's cities and drop bombs out of it. He saw that right away. I think it's Benjamin Franklin even said, imagine if you built dozens or hundreds of these and you filled them with soldiers. Back in those days, you could only get a small number of men in each balloon or the basket beneath the balloon. But still, imagine building hundreds of them, maybe thousands, who knows? It's just a thought experiment at that time. But imagine you build a whole fleet of these, fill them with soldiers as much as possible, then they can sort of abseil down in like way behind enemy lines, way behind enemy infantry divisions or anything, maybe at night, maybe a secret attack, and you can abseil them down wherever you want in your enemy's territory. And, you know, he said something, I can't remember the exact words, but he said something like, no king or leader or general has ever had to deal with such a thing. it would be a game changer. And well, he sort of, you can see there, the first colonels, first idea of paratroops. It's basically describing paratroops, isn't he? And he's not wrong. You know, it took 150 plus years before that became a reality, but there you go. Like a lot of inventions, perhaps I think maybe like AI these days or drones, the military application is only just beginning to be dreamt of, and it could go a crazy way. Like, it's often the way with inventions or technology, that the first tiny thing, that the first kernel of the invention, you could barely imagine how it would go from there, right? So you've got the first French air balloons in the late 18th century. Fast forward, and you've got the B-2. Fast forward, and you've got like an F-22 Raptor, right? Where men have taken it to sort of crazy lengths. I think maybe of the first piston, like the Newcomen engine or something that James Watt built. Fast forward, you've got like a dragster, a top fuel dragster engine. We've got like a tiny little V8 that's like only a few inches across. You know, could James Watt have ever imagined that his first engine, his first piston, could possibly become that? Okay, so balloons still before the Wright brothers at Kitty Hawk ever took off in 1903, you still had quite a few decades of hot air balloons, or dirigibles, as they would often call them, or zeppelins. And they'd been used in the military sense, not to really drop bombs very often, but usually for reconnaissance. So instead of using sort of light cavalry to reconnoiter where the enemy is on the ground, you just send up a balloon with a man in it, single man often, and you could just see where the enemy is from miles and miles and miles away. They did that in the US Civil War in the 1860s, right? So by the late 19th century or the very, very early 20th century, they've taken the idea of zeppelins and dirigibles quite far. You know, they can actually do military things, can drop bombs from them. Might even have been possible to make it a gun platform, shoot a gun, even a heavy gun, from one of them. Science fiction writers had made a great deal out of this. Both Jules Verne and H.G. Wells had written about the possible application of dirigibles in a military context. H.G. Wells wrote a book called War in the Air, where the German air fleet sends hundreds and hundreds of zeppelins over the Atlantic secretly in a sneak attack, Pearl Harbor style, and bombs New York. And it takes the Americans by surprise so utterly, and it's so sort of terrifying and they're completely defenseless, that they give in. The United States give in, and Germany conquer the United States that way. Of course, nothing like that ever happened. It's pure science fiction. But nonetheless, you can see how people knew that there was this thing coming, power in the air. And of course, once there were the actual powered flight, then that really is a game changer. Because just to finish up on balloons, zeppelins and things, it became quite clear by World War One that they weren't all that good. Of course, you've got the Hindenburg disaster. So filling them with hydrogen or any sort of flammable gas means that they're sort of ridiculously vulnerable. Who would have thought that they'd be ridiculously vulnerable? And certainly once the enemies of specifically Germany deliberately made anti-Zeppelin baffles and measures, then it was seen they were no good, really. I mean, the Germans did use Zeppelins to fly over Paris at the beginning, towards the beginning of World War One, drop a few bombs, just handheld bombs, really, kill very, very few people, or fly them over Paris and drop pamphlets saying, give up, you can't possibly beat Imperial Germany, you must give up. So use them for things like that, and still use them for reconnaissance. At one point in 1915, the Germans flew some Zeppelins over London, and I think they dropped a few bombs, but it didn't really do anything. It panicked people, but the casualties were extremely minimal. So, you know, it's not really a war-winning tool. And even once you replaced the flammable gas with non-flammable gas, it's still, you know, it's not going to change the course of a war, that sort of thing. But nonetheless, even before the Wright brothers actually took off, people knew that we would be close. In the few years before 1903, everyone sort of knew that mankind, civilization, was close to powered flight. It wouldn't be long. We sort of knew we would be able to do it. And so even by 1899, there was a Hague Convention, something like an earlier Geneva Convention, where the great powers of the world got together and tried to agree on sort of rules of conduct during war. It nearly all goes out of the window when World War One kicks off, but nonetheless, try and limit each other's, come to an agreement, sort of limit the size of navies, things like this. And the Tsar, the Russian Tsar, in 1899 said, let's maybe not have any air component to our armies. Why can't we all agree? It's so terrifying and such a change in dynamic that it would ruin the entire balance of power in the whole world. And why don't we all agree to just not do that? You know, and it's not as crazy as it might sound straight off the bat, because, you know, such things have been done before. Not exactly that, but, you know, equivalent. Like today, we've got all sorts of arms agreements about how many nukes the biggest countries can have and all that sort of thing. Or some countries can't have any. So it is possible for the global community to sit down and agree such things. Although you can imagine this one was a bit of a stretch. And it was obviously too much. But the Tsar didn't want it because it would be expensive and other people will probably already have the drop on them in technology. The British were kind of up for it because we were the world's greatest navy and an island, and our greatest navy protected our island. And any sort of large air wing can just fly over the channel and ignore the Royal Navy. So it's in our interest, the British interest, to perhaps limit or even completely ban air warfare. The French were up for it because arguably they were the greatest land force in the world, certainly in Europe. Well, no, in the world. So again, that would sort of ruin them. It could potentially even ruin them in all sorts of ways if one of the other countries, Germany, got a drop on them in terms of air capabilities. So some of the very, very biggest players were not completely deaf to the idea of, you know, completely banning air forces. In fact, even between the wars, between World War One and World War Two, when there was the League of Nations, again, the idea was floated. Why don't we all have either none or an extremely limited air capability? And, you know, perhaps the League of Nations can have a monopoly on aircraft of war. If anyone's going to have them, maybe just the League of Nations can have them. When they have to step in to prevent wars, that was the idea in all sorts of ways, a bit like the UN, supposed to be a peacekeeping force for the whole world. Maybe if they've got a monopoly on it, maybe that would work. And, you know, because it's very, very difficult to stop progress, you know, to entirely stop men from designing things. It's very, very difficult. So maybe at least we could let the League of Nations have a monopoly on it. And once again, the Brits, the French, the Russians, even the Americans thought it wasn't, some of them anyway, thought it wasn't such a ridiculous idea. But of course, it never happened. One of the things is, once you realise that you're in a total war, you know, and the gloves are off, you're not likely to agree to such reasonable things like that. So during World War One, the advancement of aeroplanes exploded. Again, pun not intended. If you look at the aeroplanes, the first things to fly in 1903, 04, 05, and you look at where they were in 1913, 1914, at the beginning of World War One, they've advanced quite a long way, but not a crazy long way. Those very, very early World War One planes are extremely rickety. I mean, I consider them like death traps. I wouldn't want to get in one. Extremely flimsy and rickety and primitive, basically. But by 1918, only 4 years later, but, you know, a world war, skull-crushing, all-or-nothing world war in between, it's crazy. By the end of 1918, the amount that aerial technology had come on is massive, absolutely massive. Because, you know, a lot of the biggest powers are prepared to throw as much money and energy at it as they can. Maybe that's a slight exaggeration, but, you know, lots of money and energy, research and development, is put into it. So by the end of World War One, you know, you've got much, much better fighter planes. They can do aerobatics and things. You've got big, relatively big bombers. The Hadley Page bomber springs to mind. But still nothing as big as what came quite soon after. But still, for the time, giant aircraft. When the Hadley Page bombers first came out to the war in the East against the Ottomans, people couldn't believe their eyes. It was It was insane to them. How could such a thing possibly fly? It was so massive and heavy. But nonetheless, a lot of people knew that the end of World War One may well prove to just be something like a hiatus before there was another giant world conflagration. I mean, people were literally calling it in 1919 after the signing of the Versailles Treaty. There's literally like punch cartoons saying, well, by the late 30s or by 1940, it'll all kick off again. And certainly by the late 20s or certainly by the mid 30s, everyone knew there was going to be almost certainly be some sort of giant war again. And so people knew that air power would be an important part in this next big war.
If you would like to see the full version of this premium video, please head over to lotuseaters.com and subscribe to gain full access to all of our premium content.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18+ in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.